Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out. In the first series, I, author and musician Gary Abbott, ranked all the Beatles' core catalogue releases with the help of my Beatles expert brother Paul. In series 2, we worked our way through an assortment of added Beatles goodies, such as Live at the BBC, the anthology series and the movies. And now for series 3, we're looking at all the post-Beatles singles released in the decade following their breakup. As with series 1, we will take 5 songs in random order each week and score them for music, production and lyrics to find the best post-Beatles Beatles hits. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. Welcome to series 3, episode 9, and welcome to Paul Right Now Abbott.
No, thank you. That's what are you in calling to mind free there? Is that what you
were? I guess so. It rhymes. Also, you sang Paul All Right Now at our dad's wedding. So,
did I?
Yes, you did.
Wowzers. Did he want me to?
Well, there may well be footage to prove it.
Oh, no.
I'd forgotten all about it too, but I'll talk about that some other time.
Yeah, this is irrelevant. And
Don't forget you can keep in touch with us at big_sort on Twitter and Instagram or by email to bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And do please drop us a review on whatever platform you're listening on if you can, and like and share our posts. And check the episode description for links to our various music and other projects. I mean, I suppose I should say we are still on Twitter, and Twitter is still there. So that's where we will stay. I think it's too confusing to start setting up like carpetbagging accounts on other ones until we really know what's happening.
It's sort of would be a shame to lose Twitter for our shop front, as it were, for the podcast. And at the moment, it doesn't feel like we need to. Luckily, we've garnered a nice little community, let's say. Yeah. There's a good Beatles community between us and the various other podcasts and enthusiasts like Hugh and Teatlemania and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's nice, which is why we like to sort of chat, and if you put messages on there, we will read them and respond and stuff like that. So
yeah,
and always, you know, if you listen to an episode and you want to tell us what your favorite out of the 5 is, please do. We always find that very interesting.
Yeah, I like it. I do like it hearing when people comment on things that we've said in the moment whilst we've been podcasting, and it's obviously resonated with someone.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't have a clue if people didn't pick us up on it.
Yeah,
it's normally my friend Pete,
yeah,
otherwise known as Old Rope, who normally picks me up on it either on Twitter or in real life.
Yeah, but, quite right too.
And I go, what did I say?
So, Paul, have you got any general Beatles business before we get onto the business of the Beatles day? That was a hard sentence.
Not particularly, but it's safe to say we are very quickly approaching the holiday season. Mm. I suppose if you're in America, you're in your holiday season. Okay. We're recording this on Thanksgiving, in fact, in America.
Okay.
And so there'll be, you know, our Christmas break coming up, and we'll be announcing what's going on over that little period, won't we, soon enough?
We can give a little hint, aren't we? We're going to do
a hintlet.
Well, we're on episode 9. We'll get episode 10 done. And then in traditional series 1 style, that normally puts us at a bonus land, but that will probably be Christmas episode land.
Yes.
And then we'll probably have a little break ourselves over Christmas to give us some time to recoup and regenerate, because we're both Time Lords.
Ugh. Who's writing our stories? That's what I want to know. Anyway, let's not get into Doctor Who problems.
Okay.
Yeah, we did say at some point we were going to do the Ringo TV special, weren't we?
Oh yeah, we were. I mean, that could be another bonus, couldn't it? But this series probably will have space for 2 bonuses and then a cap off, I think.
Yeah. Oh, and also there may be something else coming along quite different to our normal episodes as well, and more news on that as it happens.
Yeah. We'll keep you drip fed with stuff over the kind of Christmas New Year period whilst we're getting ourselves ready for the next 10 episodes. But let's stick with episode 9, where we are right now. I mean, it feels like Christmas is around the corner. It's still a month away. But Paul, on this Beatles day would be the 28th of November.
Yeah. And it seems silly, given the theme of this series, even though we've already mentioned it, not to go back to the 28th of November 1974, which was Thanksgiving in 1974.
Okay.
When Elton John was doing his Thanksgiving show at Madison Square Garden, and where John got up and did his 3 songs, having essentially lost a bet about whether whatever gets you through the night was going to get to number one or not.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I mentioned it back in the episode where we covered Whatever Gets You Through the Night, or Wuggitin, if you want to do the initials. And he got up and did that. Yeah. He did Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, and he did I Saw Her Standing There. And that was John's last live in-concert audience-type show. He did one more sort of live performance as part of a television special called A Salute to Lord Lou Grade, which he was sort of contractually obliged to do the following year. But yeah, getting up with Elton and his band was his last sort of in-concert performance in front of an audience.
Really? So that was like 1974? No.
Yeah.
1974. It's hard to think he went six, I know, you know, and how long he would have carried on to have gone, but the 6 years between that and his death,
yeah,
that he just, the whole 6 years with him not playing live at all. I mean, I guess he'd earned it by that point, you know.
Well,
if anyone had, the Beatles did, but, you know, the others didn't stop.
You get sort of McCartney, who's relentlessly like, I need another band, I need to be on the road, I need to be doing stuff. George, who's approaches it with sort of sense of contractual, I need to make money, I need to promote an album type thing, taking no particular joy from it, I don't think. And then Ringo just sort of bumbling around doing everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, John sort of puts the stage clothes away. He does look very cool in that concert with Elton John. You know, it's proper long hair and dark glasses John.
Yeah.
Playing his black and white Telecaster.
I've definitely seen it. I'm trying to think where that's been broadcast and how I've seen it. But I feel like I've watched the whole thing.
Yeah,
as part of a documentary or something, I might even.
I did find a review of the show from the New York Times of the period.
Yeah,
done on the 30th of November, because there would have been a day off, I think, for Thanksgiving holidays.
Yeah.
And the great thing is the terrible reproduction on a newspaper archive I've got. It's got a picture at the top of John on one side, a close up of John's face. And on the other side, a close up of Elton's face. But the reproduction is so awful. It just looks like a weird alien. Even given Elton John's sort of costumes and outfits, this is a really... I'll share it on the day of this episode. It's like,
oh, cool.
It's like, what? Who made that? Has that come out of like Lucasfilms or something?
So
go on.
Riffing on the idea. So you said about we should cover that weird Ringo TV special
in a
bonus. Would it be worth doing a bonus where we have that and John's live appearance? Because that is available. The footage of that's available. And something from Paul and George.
We'll try and cover
some notable ancillary
media.
Yeah, some notable movie, TV footage, something from the 70s for each of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool.
But in that New York Times piece, I'll just read a little bit of it. The bit where it talks about John coming on. But when Mr. Lennon came on, the garden was transformed. Not that the crowd hadn't given every indication of loving Mr. John and his music, but with Mr. Lennon, there was an electricity that sparked through the crowd long after Mr. Lennon had left the stage. Mm. I love the way it's writing Mr. John and Mr. Lennon.
Mr. Lennon. It just confusing.
Makes it much more complicated than if they'd have just said Elton and John.
Elton, John,
but then
John.
I suppose that's the same thing.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? Elton, John Lennon.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah, Mr. Lennon introduced I Saw Her Standing There as being by, quote, an old fiancé of mine called Paul. The quipster that he is.
Yeah. Ace. I feel like watching that again. Let's get on then with this week's picks, Paul.
Cool.
And the first up, talking about Mr. John Lennon, we have Cold Turkey, John Lennon.
One thing I'm sure of,
Turkey, Paul.
Well, it's Thanksgiving. There's probably some leftovers.
It is very apt, isn't it?
This is several days after Thanksgiving now. It's a very, very cold old turkey.
Do they do the same thing over there? Do you spend days eating turkey curries, turkey sandwiches, turkey stir fries, anything to use up turkey? Tell us.
They must do.
Write it on a postcard and mail it to Twitter.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not about that sort of cold turkey.
No.
Anyway, this is, yeah, Plastic Ono Band, Cold Turkey. So this is from the 60s. This is John's second solo single.
Mm-hmm.
Released on the 24th of October, 1969, with Don't Worry Kyoko on the B-side.
Which we've done. So, another set.
Yep.
Bing.
It's out on the Apple label, and it gets to number 14 in the charts for 8 weeks. Standalone single. Recording information, they start recording it in Abbey Road on the, I think, the 25th of September 1969. I found there was another date floating around, but I don't think that's right. And they do like 26 takes of it at Abbey Road. Then they go away and they remake it at Trident on the 28th of September. Then they go back to Abbey Road and do some mixing on it. But then he goes and he revisits it again on the 5th of October and adds some new overdubs and mixes it again. So it's mixed by John and, well, the producer's listed as John and Yoko Bag.
Yeah.
And it's written by John, obviously. But yeah, I think what's interesting, just to put it in context, is this is first performed publicly live by John and the band that he took to the Toronto Rock and Roll Festival on the 13th of September 1969.
Right.
So that ends up as the live piece in Toronto album later in the year. Oh, but in the meantime, he goes and he records it.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's the thing I'm thinking I've seen live, you know, the Toronto thing. Is he wearing a hat and glasses and shorter hair at that point?
No, he's got very long hair on that.
Okay, and I don't know what I'm thinking of.
Who knows? Oh, you're probably thinking of the New York, his own New York concert.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Where he does do a version of this as well.
So he recorded this, and so we explained, we should re-explain, shouldn't we, that we decided to include some of his slightly before and slightly after.
Yeah, because we're covering the solo stuff, and this is, even though it overlaps, you know, it, with Beatles time, even if it's not Beatles reality when you actually drill down into it.
Yeah.
You know, he's checked out and things like being invited to go and play the Rock and Roll Festival in Toronto and him saying yes eventually. It, you know, that's one of those line in the sand moments for John of like, I've left the Beatles, I'm off doing this with a different group.
Okay. So this was coming out of that. So it's almost overlapping with overdub still left to be done on Let It Be.
Yeah, stuff to do still. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So the song itself starts with a desperate riff, is the word I've chosen, that sets the tone for this song. And desperate, I think, to be in theme with the song, which is then backed up by Lennon's pleading, angsty vocal, a style again affected to the song's theme. So we've got one of these songs where its overall theme is dictating its performance and, you know, or vice versa.
His voice particularly, he does a vibrato on his voice that he doesn't really do anywhere else at all.
He's kind of singing almost through gritted teeth and doing that warble on his voice, and he's getting across the theme of the song. It smooths out slightly, even though he's doing a vibrato in the Cold Turkey chorus, because it goes into has a harmony. He keeps the wobble in his voice, but we get that driven chord change with the bass hitting the beat when it gets to the chorus to give it its hook. And it's musically catchy, that bit. It gives contrast to the verses, which are very stripped down, aren't they, the verses?
Yeah. It's worth mentioning who plays on this.
Mm.
It's not the same band that he took to the Toronto Rock and Roll Festival, except that Eric Clapton is on guitar.
So is Eric Clapton doing the main...
Well, I think that's John doing that, mainly. I think John's probably overdubbing a couple of guitars. I think Eric's basically playing the solo parts, which are basically the most understated Eric Clapton guitar solos you'll ever hear.
Yeah.
I think that's the order of business there in terms of John and Eric there. So in terms of an Eric Clapton guitar solo, it's probably one of my favourite ones because it's so unlike an Eric Clapton guitar solo at the sort of middle bit.
Again, it's all restrained.
And
all,
at the end.
It's all through clenched fingers, isn't it?
Yes, like you're right. Yeah. So you've got John, obviously, on his vocals and guitars. You've got Eric on guitar. You've got Klaus on bass.
Yep.
And you've got Ringo on drums.
Oh.
So you've got two Beatles.
Yeah.
So it's very much the Plastic Ono Band core
that
you get from that sort of Plastic Ono Band album. And it's, they do a brilliant line in clever sparseness.
Yes, absolutely. And as the song develops and he starts to get more angsty, and by the time he promises, you know, he'll promise us anything to get out of the hell, he's opening up his vocal and the music is opening a bit. Hi-hat joins. It makes sense. I didn't think about it being Ringo. It's got an understated Ringo thing as well, hasn't it? Is that Ringo is so happy to stick on what he does that when a hi-hat
So that then
joins,
when he does like the fill on the snare, which is a really, really simple fill, you know, in terms of musical technicality, it really makes sense. It just works brilliantly.
Because, yeah, he sticks in a hi-hat and the guitar riff goes kind of double time. So rather than being... It starts going... And everything starts to ramp up. John starts his primal screaming. The bass settles into the groove to keep it moving whilst he does his whole minute of, you know, withdrawal screams.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned primal scream there because, of course, John's very well known for being one of, you know, the adherents of Arthur Janov's or Janov's primal scream treatment, John and Yoko. Although that actually happens in 1970, so he's basically doing the primal scream therapy here before he's actually gone off to have it done by, you know, Dr. Arthur Janov.
So he's by accident here. He's doing it because he's acting out. Well, we'll get onto that with the lyrics, but the withdrawal, isn't he? And as he's doing that, a new guitar, which is Clapton, I guess, joins in with the feedback and starts just kind of wailing and ringing out and just kind of echoing that angsty kind of sustain. It's difficult listening in a way, but it's doing exactly what it's meant to be against a pretty simple backdrop musically, but effective. And I think sometimes we find John is most effective when the music is less complex. And he's able to capture the personality of a song. And then it ends with a bit of backwards tape that I think is because that's probably, because it bridges onto the next song on the album, but it's standalone, isn't it? So it must have just been a bit weird little ending. I think musically, though, I think it's great. I'm going to give it 87 for music.
Yeah, I think you summed it up. The guitar playing in this is mimicking the body. It's mimicking the pain, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like stabbing pains. It's sort of clenching.
Yeah. He's letting the feedback kind of... He's like wailing with it. He's not pushing it. He's not forcing it. Yeah, it's great. I don't know what that sound I just made was.
Here's a question, though, before you move on, Gary.
Yeah.
John took this to the Beatles and said, "Guys, I've written the next single."
Really?
And they sort of went... Cha-la-la. And so he's like, "Well, I'll do it myself then." And obviously Ringo ends up on it anyway.
Yeah.
But can you imagine, like, the Beatles doing this in 1969, 70?
It's distinctly John. It's got a bit of the Glass Onion type of rawness about it from a White Album kind of feel. But I think the theme would have been so overtly what it's about that it would be a marked shift in it. And I don't think the minute's worth of kind of withdrawal screaming would have been a bit much for the Beatles audience at the time, or some of them anyway. It would have been... But then that's what he was trying to shed some of that, wasn't he? He was trying to cast some of that off. So that's perhaps makes sense why he wasn't working for him at that point. Because
I think it's interesting. If you listen to the version on the Toronto Rock and Roll Festival, where it's like the first time they've played it, you know, they've rehearsed it on the plane on the way over with that particular band he has with him there. It's much more of a down-the-line rock thing than it becomes. And you would just imagine the Beatles might have started out going in that direction and it might never have ended up like Cold Turkey by John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band.
It'd be quite nice, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way. It'd be quite interesting to have heard the version where Paul McCartney sticks a middle eight in it.
Yeah,
you know, and to see if that kind of what that would do to it. But no, I can and I can't. It does feel very. It feels like John was right, even though, well, he wasn't right. I think the others were right to kind of go like, "This is one of yours. This is a John song. That's best served by not being restrained by what maybe people expect the Beatles to do or not do." Interesting that. Production then. So we've got the great kind of dirty guitar distortion sound forming the main element of this song, beside John's voice, of course.
Yeah.
And talking about John's voice, and the screaming bit, that must have been quite a tricky session, because obviously if you stand next to a microphone and start screaming, it can go all over the shop. You've got to do it. Yeah. I imagine he was waving his head around a bit like a Muppet, kind of keeping his head back from the microphone as he went louder and things.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm. I haven't got the evidence for that, but I think if you think that when they first tried it, they did 26 takes. I wonder how much of that he was doing as a like in a band thing that he was going to overdub later, and perhaps whether he tried overdubbing there or whether he was singing live.
Mm.
You know, because like I say, there are live performances of this where he's going. You know, it's quite a musical withdrawal screaming sound. You know, it's not just pure raw screaming. He makes some interesting noises.
He does, but he's not hitting notes as such. I mean, there's notes in there, but it's and he's doing some of it in a kind of a time. It's a kind of a build, but it's Anyway, the bass sound is great.
Yeah, that's my favourite bit about it, because it's like they've rounded off the bass sound, taken out quite a lot of the top end.
Yeah,
so there's no clank to it. It's this weird. It's almost like a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And that again is like it's like the song is body, it's a physical thing.
And as we said with the Clapton stuff, because it's all feedback and
just sort of bent notes, bendy notes, sort of thing.
They've just got a huge amount of gain on a guitar, meaning that it just makes that resonates out and kind of shrieks.
That
and
first wails. Solo sort of pongs across from the left to the right.
Yeah,
in the headphones, ping pong across. Pew.
Yeah.
Again, we must say the main mix you'll hear now is the ultimate mix. Yeah, so it's quite hard to find the you know, if you haven't got the original version to actually hear the original mix, but there's not much difference, I don't think.
No, drums sound good, maybe snares a little thin, could be a bit thicker.
It's just such a simple thing, isn't it? You know, a musical decision and a production decision. You don't need a big thumping great, that awful version of Ringo's snare that you sometimes get where it feels like it's the size of a dustbin.
Yeah, and I think and when the toms play along with the bass, it definitely, now you've said it as well, makes me think how that interplay between Ringo's tom playing and the bass and stuff works really well. So I think the thing is with this, they could have easily gone a bit mad with it. You could have decided to add a lot of uncomfortable and dark sounds, but they didn't, and that was the right decision. And it's a very distinct sounding song where the production is working around and with the theme. So I'm going to give it 90 for production.
Oh.
Because I think it's distinctly Cold Turkey.
Yeah.
So lyrics then, Paul.
Well, there you go.
We all know what this is about, don't we?
It's
about Cold Turkey, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the silly thing is, it seems so obvious what this song is about now, and maybe that's just because we're all a lot more au fait with drugs and drug-related terminology or addiction, language around addiction. But, you know, at the time, there was media people saying, oh, it's a song about drugs.
Yeah.
It's not. It's a song about no drugs.
Well, it's the opposite, isn't it? I guess it implies the existence of drugs prior to the point of this song, doesn't it? But I have to say,
it's definitely not encouraging people to take drugs. 36 hours rolling in pain.
Oh, exactly. Well, that's it. I mean,
yummy heroin.
Yeah, I mean, when I first heard of this song, which would have been in my, I don't know, probably quite young, because we were having Lennon collections around and things, which I think we did, and CDs. I think that I probably didn't know what Cold Turkey meant. And if you don't know that, it could take on a very whole other cartoonish kind of complexion, this song, can't it?
Yeah.
But it certainly isn't cartoonish when you know the topic and of heroin withdrawal. And like you say, if there's any argument that some of the Beatles' music possibly drew people towards certain drugs, then I think this song hopefully repelled them against... away from potential heroin use.
Yeah, I mean, John and Yoko's heroin usage is a matter of, well, not a matter of debate. It's been something that's been covered a lot. You know, there's that awful Albert Goldman book about John Lennon, which basically has him as a horrific heroin addict.
Mm.
But then the other side of it is him saying, yeah, we did heroin for a bit. We didn't shoot up. We used to take it in different ways. And then we went cold turkey through this period. I mean, I suspect the truth is, you know, things are different depending on when you dip in. I'm sure he probably doesn't remember what he did during the lost weekend, although I suspect mainly beer. Yeah, so there's no point going into that, but it is worth, because of the subject of this song, it has been discussed a lot, and people, John was asked about it a lot, and he basically says, cold turkey is self-explanatory. It was a result of experiencing cold turkey withdrawals from heroin. Everybody goes through a bit of agony sometime or another in their lives, whatever it is. Cold turkey is just an expression that is suitable to explain the other side of life. And that's it, essentially. You know, he was asked about it at the time, and he made some glib comments about, well, cold turkey can be anything. You know, we had the car crash, we had to go cold turkey. And he wasn't talking about drugs. You know, Yoko had her miscarriages, we had to get through that cold turkey. But, I mean, it's withdrawal.
Yeah, it is. It's basically the scene in Transporting with the baby's head spinning all the way around, made into music, isn't it? So yeah. I'm going to give it 83 for lyrics, and that's 86.7 altogether.
We'd be remiss to move on from this before we mention it as well, of course, that this is around the time where he sends the telegram to Her Majesty the Queen returning his MBE.
Ah, right.
And the entire content of which is, Your Majesty, I'm returning this MBE in protest against Britain's involvement in the Nigeria-Biafra thing, against our support of America in Vietnam, and against cold turkey slipping down the charts. With love, John Lennon. Glib.
Okay, then. Next, Paul. Blow Away, George Harrison. All I got to do is to love you. All I got to be is to be happy. All it's got to take is someone to make it blow away, blow away, blow away. Sky cleared up, day turned to bright. Blow away, George Harrison, Paul.
I probably couldn't. I'm not the big bad wolf. silly, isn't it?
Silly boy.
But then the video for this is very silly, so yeah. That's quite good. Blow Away by George Harrison is from the George Harrison album. It's the main single from the George Harrison album.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a song called Soft Touch on the B-sides. It comes out mid-February 1979. On the Dark Horse label, and only gets to number 51 in the charts for 5 weeks, which is a travesty.
Yeah.
Recorded at FP Shot, George's home studio, sometime between April and October 78, while I was busy being born.
Mm.
Not during that entire period. You know, wasn't that difficult, the pregnancy. Written by George, produced by George and Russ Titelman, and is simply probably George's best pop song, so
it is a good song. It is a good pop song. It's a little bit.
I'll brook no denial.
No, I'm not going to deny it. It's a little bit different from George, because while still being distinctly George, George goes pop here more or less, but with his little twist. Still has
his little twist.
Chord twist. The verses are very conventional, and good for it. I think a pleasant progression of chords that allow some nice guitar riffs. And is it electric piano? What's that name? Is it clav or something?
Well, the lineup on this is we've got George doing his vocals, playing 12-string, slide and electric guitars, backing himself up on vocals as well. Neil Larson on electric piano, Andy Newmark on drums, Willie Weeks on bass, Ray Cooper on percussion, Del Newman's doing the string arrangement. I can't find out who's on glockenspiel. And I feel the glockenspiel's very important to this song. It's the little sound of sunlight on it.
Yeah.
Essentially, this is the song where George invents twee indie pop.
Yeah, it is.
Acoustic guitars and glockenspiels.
Which
I love, by the way.
Yeah. It is very indie, actually, when you think about it. 90s kind of twee indie as well. It's very pleasant. It's a nice melody. And then when we get into the verses, and then the chords, the chorus settles into a very pop hook melody line. With some slightly unconventional chords under them, but only lightly.
Yeah, not the usual complete.
But
George
still,
madness.
Still George though. Still like.
Yeah,
it's still
I agree.
Like. Would it go? Oh, it goes there. It goes there, and then it goes there, and it, you know, he could have done a round of four and come back to the beginning, but he doesn't. He kind of almost modulates it and then doesn't, and then but it works because he's
Who
consistent.
Who wants an illustration?
Go on then.
Where have I put me plectrum? Oh, there it is. Yeah, it's worth mentioning the chorus, just the chorus. Like you say, the chorus is basically a round of.
Yeah.
Which is very regular.
That's very regular, yeah.
Yeah, it basically goes like.
Yeah. That's. Yeah, it suddenly stops being just four chords round and round and becomes about eight and nine, doesn't it? Because he's changed the key-ish. Kind
basically,
of thing.
So he's in D, and he's so that means he's thrown in chords like B minor and F sharp minor. Hmm. But then he's got that F, an F natural in there.
Yeah.
And then he gets nice resolution on that.
The Who
suspended
style
thing.
Suspended fourth, which it's hard to hear without thinking of The Who, because they use that a lot. And
although I do believe, I think he probably plays it on a capo.
Mm.
So if for anyone who doesn't know, and this is one of the sort of things that good old Jeff Lynne likes to do.
Yeah.
And not that Jeff Lynne's involved here, but it's sort of, you know, it crops up in certain ways, is you have someone playing the chords open on the guitar, then you put a capo on, you change your chord shape, but it still sounds the same, but with a different
range
structure of the order of the notes, essentially. So you end up with,
you can get a similar effect
on a fifth fret,
by someone playing all the chords barred further up the neck and someone playing them more open on the lower.
In this instance, I think it is just the capoed guitar rather than layers of it, and I think it's probably a capoed 12 string as well. Which makes it sound very bright and slightly brittle in a very nice, shiny, shimmery sort of way.
So I've estimated, regarding his chords, that it's about 30% Harrison Strange Chords on this Harrison Strange Chords scale.
Yep.
But the tune over them is still easy to grab onto, even as the chords take twists and turns, which means you can kind of sing along to it and you don't have to. It's still a bit more difficult than your average song because of those chord changes. But in true pop form, the catchy chorus is hammered home and repeated a good few times with pretty short verses and bridges, just there to kind of give you a reason to hear the chorus come back in every now and again, which it does at least a half a dozen times, which is nice, and the harmonies are good, but that's why it's pop, isn't it? It's very much, this is the bit, it's a pop song, you're going to hear the chorus a lot, you're not going to spend too much time getting to it, but you'll have a bit of time away from it and coming back. If anything, that makes the arrangement slightly more on the basic scale. I think it's a fun, nice pop song. It's definitely George's nicest pop song, but it doesn't mean...
I think he was a little bit sort of embarrassed by it. He's sort of written it and gone a bit like, this is a bit a bit pop, this is a bit sort of normal. It's And yet, I think it's an absolutely brilliant song. I think it's absolutely beautiful.
And I'm going to give it 76 for music, which is a good, really nice pop song. But as I said, I think he does more interesting music generally. But as far as good pop song, you just wonder why it didn't do better in the charts, because you'd think it would have more mass appeal. But, you know, maybe because
I should have had a look at what was around at the time when this was released, because it might be that the whole sort of nature of the sort of thing people were buying was so different at the time.
Yeah, and maybe people didn't want George Harrison to do this kind of pop and they weren't expecting it all.
Well, they weren't buying much of his singles anyway in the UK, at least.
So let's do into production then. I mean, I think this is more like it compared to some of the other George ones, I think. I think because, you know, he's got some of his problems with some of the All Things Must Pass album and bits with his voice. This is nicely put together. The electric piano, and the Glock are adding those trebly, sparkly tones over the clean double acoustics that you've just talked about, which create this airy, uplifting sound. It's a soft, rhythmic, gentle, yet fairly pacey combo that sits nicely with the drums. It's a commercial, sparkly song, isn't it, Paul?
It is, I've got very little to say about the production, really. It's just really nice for what it is. It's well balanced. It lets his voice shine through.
Mm.
It's got a really great slide solo, and it's so that doesn't sort of over-dominate at all. It's probably one of George's best slide solos as well in this.
Yeah.
You know, simple and effective.
Yeah, it's a commercial sound with lovely George kind of his lead all over it, and There's some strings in there in a commercial way, quite soft in the background, just to glue it all together. His voice is good throughout. I'm going to give it 82 for production.
Yeah. I'd like to mention at this point, it's not really production, but it does have a video to this, which is clearly made in an afternoon by Neil Innes.
Oh, yeah.
So Neil Innes directed the video for this. And I love that you get to see George doing some funny sort of smiles, doing some shadows dancing, you know, dancing like the shadows footsteps.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's like, he's sat in a porcelain duck or riding a nodding dog and stuff like that. And annoyingly, the official, like the quality of the official video of this that you get through his website and on YouTube is so low.
Yeah.
It really needs
like
a proper restoration.
It's like someone's recorded it off the telly, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And that's the official one. It needs a proper restoration because it's a great song and it's a great fun video. I mean, I saw a lot of people discussing it on the internet saying, this is a stupid video, there's a thing with a duck in it. I assume that was the voice
that's
what
they sounded like.
Yeah. And I think, no, it's George with his mate doing something silly and smiley.
Daft.
You know.
Yeah.
So there, that's my thing to add to production, video production.
Okay, well, 82 for production I've given it. I can't give it video points or the internet would go wild. So lyrics then. He's back with his weather lyrics again. George the Weatherman.
Is this George's fixing a hole?
Day to turn black sky ripped apart. Rain for a year till it dampened my heart. Cracks and leaks. The floorboards caught rot. About to go down. I had almost forgot.
He's using home maintenance as a route into a song.
This old house. He's not the first one, is he?
Like fixing a hole.
Yeah.
So, there you go.
Yeah, but he's also talking about sky cleared up, day turned to bright. He's on about rain again. And sun coming back. Coming, you know, coming here, it's coming back, it's that sun that there is.
It's coming back there, that sun.
It's just, you know, wind blew in, cloud was dispersed, rainbows appearing, the pressures were burst. Breezes are singing, now feeling good. I mean, it's, he does live in weather and nature lyrics, you know, which is fine. And yes, he is using it as a metaphor for getting over something. You know, it's all sunshine and yin and yang once the rain's gone away. It's kind of pretty basic stuff in a way. There's no real explanation as to how to make the clouds blow away. He just kind of says, oh, just remember to be happy, you know.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Look, so in I, Me, Mine, this is the very last entry in the book.
All right.
And it's quite a big entry about it as well.
Yeah.
Again, he goes on about Formula One. It was sitting in the garden in a hut looking at the water as it was pouring with rain. We were having leaks in the house because some drain had blocked and I'd gone out in my hat and raincoat and was down there in the hut getting away from it all. George, there's a leak in your house, George. Right, I'm off to the shed. The problems start when you get attached to the problems, he says. That's when the mind gets involved in too much thinking of whether one is supposed to go here or do this or that. You know, the bullshit. So he's like, I'm not dealing with this, is essentially what he's saying there.
Right.
I was feeling rotten, a bit ratty, not feeling good in myself, and it was all getting to me, getting next to me. I remember, again, that isn't me. And he basically goes on about the biggest thing that screws us up in life is the mind. It plays tricks on us.
Yeah.
I thought, I don't have to feel all this. I do love everybody. And basically that became blow away, that sort of notion of him trying to figure himself out again in that situation.
Yeah.
But I do think it's worth mentioning. It's like, then I thought the tune was so obvious somehow, I got a bit embarrassed by it and didn't want to play it to anybody. But when I recorded it, I actually liked it more. The end of I, Me, Mine by George Harrison.
Oh, there we go. That's strange to finish with that. A song that got to no foot higher than number 50 in the chart. But I think the lyrics, I mean, it's great that means all that to him, but in the lyrics themselves, they in and of themselves, they sound like, it's rainy, but don't forget, be happy, and now I'm happy, and that's it. It's fine. It's great because it's a happy little pop song, but then you know they're not massively thought-provoking. So 69, I've given the lyrics, which gives it 75.7 altogether.
Right.
A pleasant little song. Next, Little Woman Love, Wings. Little Woman Love Wings, Paul.
Little Woman Love Wings?
Little Woman Love Wings.
Do they? Little Tiny Angels.
Yes.
Flying off. Yeah, right. Little Woman Love by Wings. The B-side to Mary Had a Little Lamb, which we haven't discussed yet. That's going to be interesting when that comes out.
Right.
Released on the 12th of May, 1972 on Apple. It gets to number 9 for 11 weeks. It's in the charts. It was recorded during the Ram sessions, but it wasn't an album single. So okay. That means it was recorded in CBS Studios in New York with overdubs in A&R Studios in New York and mixed back in Abbey Road by Paul, produced by Paul, credited to Paul and Linda. And it's some boogie woogie.
A boogie woogie. Is it... who's playing the boogie woogie piano, Paul? Is it Paul?
Paul.
Paul, all the way through. Okay. So yeah, it's a fun little 2 minutes of boogie woogie. It's got some great, am I right in saying it's a stride piano
kind of style? You would call that sort of thing, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the left hand doing
it's not. It's not dissimilar to sort of Lady Madonna. Yeah. It's not a million miles away from
exactly
those sort of stomp stride piano type.
Yeah, it's got that feeling. It's got the left hand in the kind of bass notes doing probably an octave-y kind of thing. But there's also an actual double bass on there too. So that kind of gives it almost a dual bass line, which means you get a very shuffly kind of like frenetic feeling. And the kit's doing some very shuffly stuff as well, along with some bongos or some...
Yeah, bongos or congas or something like that. There.
Gives it that frantic, fast energy. And Paul matches that up with an equally snappy little melody over the top. You know, it's good. And then we have... We have a little point of difference than just straightforward boogie woogie with that the little oh yeah sections, which kind of go almost like they're going to go dark and rocky and a bit proggy, you know, when he hits do the
oh. Never quite get that far away from.
Yeah,
from
but it's only briefly, and then they're like snap back to the funny movie jiggly type
boop,
of
boop,
song.
Boop, boop, boom, boom.
Yeah, it's a great little bit of catchiness, really. And along with a nice bit of lead doing its thing, it's kind of throwaway as well, because it feel like
it is, yeah.
They went, hey, this is fun, we can do this, let's do it for like 2 minutes and then stop. that'll be about right.
I do like the little that he's used, basically there is some nice little electric guitar touches, but I like the fact that the acoustic is the main guitar in it, you know. It's doubled up across the, you know, panned across the speakers.
There's some interesting choices that come into production, I think, as well as what they've used.
Quite simple,
but I mean, it just sounds like the opening to every Later with Jules Holland show, doesn't it? That's the thing. It's just it's that kind of boogie woogie that, you know, you pan into the studio and Jules Holland is doing this whilst the someone like the Killers look awkwardly in the corner like he's playing boogie woogie over us. So it's 73 I'm giving it for music.
Yeah. I think it's worth mentioning. Quick lineup check. This is Wings with Paul, Linda, David Spinoza, Hugh McCracken, and Denny Seiwell, and we have as a guest artist on this someone called Milt Hinton.
Milt Hinton.
And he's the guy playing the stand-up bass, the double bass,
right,
in that slap sort of style. Yeah. So Milt Hinton.
He's the kind of guy you want to call Hilt Minton, isn't
Mint
he?
Hilton, Mint. Which is what you get on your pillows when you go to a posh hotel. Milt Hinton, who was in part of Cab Calloway's band.
Oh, yeah.
So he was like very early. He was born in 1910. So he was part of Cab Calloway's orchestra. And then when Cab Calloway sort of downsized, as many of those big bands did in later years, he was sort of part of the ensemble there. And he's just a phenomenal upright bass player. And so it's good that Paul didn't try and do it himself. He, you know, he got someone in who could really play in the style and get that percussive effect alongside it.
You get the feeling that Paul probably started this song by figuring out that piano thing and going, ooh, that's fun. I need someone to play bass with me so I can play this on the piano. Because, you know, it's a cool little piano riff. So onto the production. I like the style of this. As you just talked about, the double bass. You know, a double bass and piano bass gets a nice playoff between the two. Although I think for having such a good double bass player in, I think it could have been a bit louder in the mix. I think
it is a little hidden away.
Yeah, and because when there's a break and you hear the bass, it has its little feature. It just does a couple of notes, doesn't it? Kind of, it breaks and the bass kind of goes do do do, and you think, oh, it is quite soft in there.
Yeah,
and you think if that's been soft all that way through, like, against everything else going on, it's doing something for it. I like that small hint that comes in of that bigger, darker progression where the distorted guitar starts to underpin.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, it's just marking out that progression of the chords, isn't it? It does that thing where
he double tracks those, like he does with the acoustic, he double tracks them, and so you've got those spread across left and right speakers going.
There's a thing where you can, when you do a progression of chords, and you can just pick out a single note that kind of moves with them. It just adds that kind of build the epic thing. It's got what strings would normally do as well, but he's doing it on a distorted guitar. But yeah, there's not much else to talk about because that's it. It's only a couple of minutes, isn't it? So
yeah.
I'm going to give it 76 for production.
You'd have thought if he'd have been recording this back in England, he would probably have done it in Abbey Road, and he probably would have whipped out the Mrs. Mills piano and done that sort of thing. But he didn't. No. So there.
So lyrics then, Paul. I mean,
we have to talk about the lyrics.
Yeah,
this isn't in the lyrics book.
No, I mean, unfortunately, this is might be where it suffers. I got a little woman I can really love. My woman fit me like a little glove.
Hate it.
You know I'll always love my little woman love. I take her home most every night. My woman love to hold me tight. You know I feel all right. My little woman mine. Yeah, it's just, I mean, my catchphrase of it's just some words. I mean, apart from oh yeah, we only essentially have two verses here. And it's just some words.
It is, and I do not like fit me like a little glove.
Fit me like a little glove, no.
It's just it's grubby. it's not like, so inevitably we're going to keep talking about Lady Madonna, but Lady Madonna's sort of quite high concept compared to this.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it's really high concept compared to this. And this, like you say, is he's gone, oh, I'm doing a boogie-woogie thing. I've got a little tune, but I can't be bothered to actually change this. It feels very first-pass lyrics.
Yes, that's exactly, yeah.
But it's an enjoyable song, but
it's destined for a B-side, isn't it? And so he's not bothered. Yeah. He's just not bothered, Paul. So that's 47 for lyrics that's getting, which gives it 65.3 overall.
It's probably worth mentioning that when he played it live, or when Wings played this live, they didn't just do it straight. They mixed it up with Sea Moon.
Oh, okay.
Which is very odd, because it means he's going Sea Moon. And he has to end Sea Moon, you know.
Okay.
And then suddenly back into It's very odd. There's footage of that online.
Oh, okay. I'm not particularly familiar with Sea Moon, I don't think.
Well, Sea Moon's sort of weird, sort of laid-back reggae thing, which is the sort of opposite of that, isn't it?
Ah, okay. Cool. Just him showing all of his genre range. Well then, let's go on to the next one, Paul, which is Down and Out, Ringo Starr.
Look in the fire, what did I see? I saw someone looking at me.
Down and Out, Ringo Starr, Paul.
Ah, but he comes out fighting. not with this, though, probably not. This is the B-side to his single Photograph, which hasn't come out yet. Looking forward to talking about that one when it does.
Uh-huh.
And Photograph gets to number 8.
Oh, yeah.
In the charts. And this single's out for 13 weeks. 19th of October, 1973. It's on Apple. This is associated with the Ringo album.
Yeah.
Although it's not on the album. It is now as a bonus track, but
right.
And it's probably recorded sometime in 1972. I couldn't find the definite details for this. If anyone knows, tell me. Either in the Apple studios or more likely during FP shot, because it was Photograph and I think this were recorded with George during the George doing his Living in the Material World album. So Ringo goes over and is working with George during that period. It's a Ringo written song, so it's a Starkey songwriting credit. And the producers are George Harrison and Richard Perry. Richard Perry, I think, gets a production credit because he would have overseen the horn overdubs.
Right.
Because we've got a very stripped down band again. We've got Ringo drumming and singing. We've got George Harrison playing, according to my notes, George Harrison playing George Harrison. So there's been a transcription error there while I was typing. George Harrison playing slide guitar, Gary Wright on piano, and Klaus on bass.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably Bobby Keys, Tom Scott, Chuck Findlay, either some or all of them playing the saxophones on it.
Oh, I was hoping you wouldn't say that someone who played the piano was called Gary, because I just thought that either Ringo was speaking to me through the ages or that I was having some kind of a breakdown when Ringo says, "All right, Gary," in the middle of the song. I'm like, "Well, yes, I'm fine. Thank you, Ringo." Ringo speaks to me. If you don't know, he does his signature Ringo introducing the soloist speak.
Yeah.
And the soloist is called Gary. And so I did not know that was going to happen. Although I guess I must have heard this because I've got this album with all the extras and I've listened to it. So it must have passed me by that time.
Well, don't pass me by. Mm. Well, there may be a reason that you don't remember it. That might be because it's just a blues slog.
Yeah, I may not have. Just zoned out by that time. I mean, it's a bit of, not a dose of, I should say, a bit of rock and roll, this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Actually, in fact, this is probably more rock and roll than a dose of rock and roll is, because this is at least quite straightforward rock and roll.
This is very much Ring the Changes rock and roll stuff. It's a three chord rocker with one little passing chord in there to just add a little bit of interest at the end of sections. It's proper, and it's in E as well, which is very much the guitarist sort of rock and roll key. So
I mean, it puts it very much in that territory of being, because it's a rock and roll three chord 12 bar blues thing, that you've got to consider everything other than the basic construction of the song, because the construction of the song is a template, a pattern that anyone can adopt and adapt by adding their own melody and instrumentation over the framework, and then they can either divert from it, or they can keep to it but do it really well. So the question you have with a song like this is it done well enough to be a worthy addition to an already very well explored genre? Is it carrying itself with virtuosity? Are the instruments doing anything making it worthwhile to hear this rock and roll song? They're not doing anything wrong, but I don't think they're the main feature. Is the vocal exemplary? Well, I mean, he sings it okay, but it's very, very much in a comfort range for him. He's not having to stretch for anything.
Totally.
Is the arrangement novel? No. I mean, the brass is fun. It's got that kind of, it's got that soul, rhythm and blues feeling of marking the beat kind of thing. But it's not doing a whole lot of heavy lifting. So it ends up just being a bit okay.
Yeah.
Just
a bit. The piano solo's nice. George's slide guitar sounds are pretty cool, but
just passes the ear by, doesn't it? It's not unwelcome, but I shan't be asking it round for dinner.
No.
Even if Ringo does directly speak to me in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it 59 for music.
Righto.
Which I think is fair enough for what's obviously a...
I just think it's a bit of a slog. I mean, I think even Ringo's drumming is pretty leaden on this.
Yeah.
It feels very much like... You know how sort of George helped Ringo and encouraged him with Octopus's Garden and it turns into an absolute masterpiece?
Yeah.
Well, he clearly sort of helped him with this and it didn't.
Right.
Clearly his attention was on doing his own stuff for living in the material world, and it's like, well, if we can do this as a three-chord rocker, we'll be all right.
Yeah, let's get through it. Filler. Production then. I don't think there's anything particularly in the production to pick up on. We've got that very standard rock and roll soul kind of brass backing. And it kind of sits fine. It's a little farty, maybe. I mean, brass can
not
be.
Much, there's not much wrong with it, really.
There's not much. There's not. I mean, the guitar sounds nice, which is George's slide, so, it goes nicely over it. There's some piano mistakes left in. Did you pick up on them? There's some.
Not really.
There's some end of phase piano mistakes, which is quite extraordinary given what the actual song is. But if you listen. There's two places where if the piano seems to have not changed chord and then it suddenly does.
Oh, dear.
So for that reason, I'm giving it 0 now. I'm giving it 71 for production.
My notes for production are, my, what an abrupt ending.
Does it just end? I can't remember.
It just stops all of a sudden. I think essentially it sounds like it's what would have just faded out in a jam, but they've clearly decided to just stop it.
Yeah, that's
enough. And it stops with this big sort of full stop of mad reverb on everything.
Right.
Just at like at one beat. Clearly it sounds like a tape edit possibly. And if it's not, then it was just a very weird decision to stop like that hard on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okie doke. Well, let's get to lyrics then. Maybe we'll find some solace in lyrics.
Where are we going to look for lyrics? Are we going to look at the sky? Are we going to look in the fire? Are we going to look in the fridge?
Yeah. I mean, he saw someone looking at him. And in two of those places, I can quite imagine this. Maybe you see yourself in the clouds, you know, or maybe even you see God looking back at you. Or you see yourself in the fire, flickering in the flames, your own soul reflected. And maybe from the fridge, you see your own mortality staring back up at you from the hummus, you know. If you're middle class, or from the marge. If you're working class.
Margarine, yeah.
No, I take it it's a joke, that last line. I mean, so that basically the structure of the song is, I looked in there something, what did I see? I saw myself looking back at me, isn't it? Something like that.
I saw someone looking at me.
Yeah, so.
But I'm down and out. Nothing seems to connect up in this.
No.
or the chorus doesn't seem to connect to the verses, and the verses are only 2 lines long. The chorus is only 2 lines long.
Yeah, and the third one is, I looked in the fridge and what did I see? And I say it's almost him going, this isn't anything really, this song. They're not very good lyrics. So I gave those lyrics a total of 43, which gives it 57.7 overall.
Right.
But, you know, there you go. Have you got anything else to say about Down and Out, Paul?
No.
Then on we must go. Finally, we have Girls' School, Wings. Girls' school, Paul?
No, I went to a mixed school in Stoke-on-Trent.
Yes.
As did you. Anyway. Yeah, right. So, the other side of this disc is Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah.
It's a double A-side.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. You know, and you could go into a lot of exploration of the difference between American and British markets as to which was most popular where.
Right.
But basically, they both counted for the charts. And in America, Girls' School got a lot more airplay than Mull of Kintyre at the time. And over here, Mull of Kintyre got more airplay than this.
Right.
Hence, Mull of Kintyre becoming a huge phenomenon.
Yeah.
Released on the 11th of November, 1977. I think that's right. I've got a note here to check it, and I haven't. Obviously, gets to number one in the UK and stays in the charts for 17 weeks. Mm. It's recorded during the London Town sessions in February to March 1977, probably on Valentine's Day, February the 14th, at Abbey Road, written by Paul, produced by Paul. And we've got, so I'll just get the lineup out of the way now. It's Paul, Linda and Denny Lane, with Jimmy McCulloch and Joe English. There was that version of Wings.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so you've got Mull of Kintyre, which we've yet to get to in this.
Yeah.
You know, quite a sort of monolithic part of McCartney's legacy. And then this is the flip side, or rather, the other A side.
Yeah.
Which is baffling if you've never heard it before.
Which I've never had. And
yeah. Just goes to show it has no legacy in the UK.
No, not at all. And I'd like to think that's because of our collective national taste. To be honest, because it's not. I will start off by declaring I'm not particularly bothered if I don't have to hear it much again. Doesn't do much for me, this song.
No, it doesn't do much for me either.
Part of my problem is I'm not exactly what it is. It's a little bit too glam rock for me, I think. I feel, but then I also feel like I should be doing some kind of twee line dancing routine to it. Not that it's country, but it's got that, like you should put your thumbs in your belt hooks and do some kind of do-si-doing to it. Like
I have belt loops. I don't use hooks on my loops.
I just, I use spikes and hooks.
That's the glam rock aspect.
Yeah, it's very cheesy. It's just got that kind of, it's that thing where you take rock and roll and you smooth it all out and it becomes that glam thing that's like, what's this now? This is the kind of thing that I would have thought would have made punk sick, you know, this kind of thing. I don't mean to be too down on it, but it's just, this is the side of it.
That's fine. People like it when you go crazy.
It just feels, I don't know, it feels like watching Hairspray, which I also dislike.
Ooh.
It has this fey rock and roll with this occasional heartbeat.
Oh, you mean the Hairspray remake, yeah. The musical film,
which has one theme that it spends about 3 hours playing. I mean, I watched it live. And it's just like, get over it. You've learned a bit of kind of rock and roll thing that you're just going to play every 2 seconds forever.
I mean, I would say go back and watch the proper original Hairspray movie by John Walters.
Yeah, I'm thinking
Walters, Waters even.
The musical version.
Not the musical thing.
Yeah, and I was subjected to it live. I mean, just the same theme keeps coming back in and in and in. It's like, oh, God. So it has this kind of occasional half-beat build-up to a bit of a rubbish chorus where it's just him singing, girls' school, I find it relentlessly annoying, to be honest, like Hairspray. Because it never lets up and it never gets going. Yeah. So it just...
Well, I'm just going to get the lyrics book because...
Oh, is he?
It's in the lyrics book.
Brilliant.
However, it's not... On Paul McCartney's website. So on Paul McCartney's website, on the discography tab, you can click to look at the albums or you can click to look at the songs and it gives you a list of all of his songs, including the tracks off like his orchestral works.
Yeah.
And if you click them, it gives you the lyrics or says this is an instrumental.
Mm.
Girls' School isn't on there, but it is in the lyrics book.
Okay, so it's not that he's
I wonder whether it's an oversight on the website.
Even the people who do his own estate haven't heard this one.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, I know we haven't gotten to lyrics yet, but just let me read the first line from the lyrics book. Sometimes when you look back, it helps to put certain lyrics into context. But we'll come to the lyrics in a minute. What I want to mention is on the reproduction of his scribbled lyrics sheet, he's got guitar tuning note at the bottom. And the note says guitar tuning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, E, A flat, E, B, E, E. Now, what he means there is open E tuning.
Mm.
Shouldn't be A flat. It should be G sharp, Paul. Get your enharmonic equivalents right.
Yeah.
But that's basically what he does, doesn't he? He's got a couple of guitars in open E tuning going over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So and there.
It's just annoying. And it just goes on. It's happy, clappy people dance around the stage while this pointless rock and roll boogie's on. Sorry, I'm talking about Hairspray again. But it just goes on and on. I'm just not fond of it. So I'm going to give it 50 for music.
Yeah, fair enough.
Production. I have something to say about production, which
say
is
it.
It's 4.5 minutes long. Why is it 4.5 minutes long? Other than that, I suppose it sounds okay, I suppose. I mean, if you want to have that this song. That repeating riff gets annoying and sits there in the same register and place in the audio throughout, which also doesn't help.
And there's certain sections where there's a sort of constant synth noise down in the lower sections, sort of muddying it up.
I noticed that. Yeah, it's there, but it's not. I said there's some synth thing modulating away here and there, but it's very vaguely there. So it's kind of like, what's it doing? So it's a kind of, it's a production and composition / arrangement note in that, like, you're thinking, well, do we need it to last 4.5 minutes if it's not really doing anything different all the way through? I mean, some of the vocals are nice. I mean, Wings harmonies are great, you know, and they sound, I think when they do them, they sound good. But there's some places where they seem to forget to do the backing along with Paul. You know, he does it there, what can a sister do bit.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's like four of them singing it, and then sometimes it sounds like it's just Paul singing it, and like they've forgotten to back him up. And then we have the strange little spoken word beginning intro thing. I don't know what that is.
Just
something. I don't know what it is. I find
we're
it a bit...
We're not onto lyrics yet, anyway.
No, but I find it a bit flat somehow. I mean, but as a production note, though, that it starts with a bit of a audio...
Yeah, it does sort of weird phased thing. Sort of three cheers.
Yeah. I find it a bit flat somehow. It's not technically bad, so I can't chastise it too strongly. So I'm going to give it 73 for production.
Okay.
So let's go then onto the lyrics for Girls' School. And I am extremely interested, before I say anything, to hear what he says in his lyrics book.
Well, I can't read it all, but no, it's quite a long bit. You know, some of them has got quite short things, but he talks about the Beatles being initiated into sex during their stay in Hamburg, what it was like going to America, what it was like when the sort of with the pill being part of the mix of the sexual revolution.
Right.
On the flip side, there was the tongue-in-cheek seaside postcard type things like the Carry On films and the Benny Hill show. So all these elements found their way into this song.
Do they?
I sort of know what he means. But then he basically says, I think this one came from seeing an ad for a porn film called Girls' School. Oh, grubby again, Macca.
Well, that sounds more like it. I think you can discount the 95% of the words before that sentence.
Yeah. It might even have said something like, see Yuki and so-and-so romp to your delight. So I thought, right, I'm going to imagine this school into a song. I thought it's a girls' school like St. Trinian's. That's grubby.
Is that what he said? That's grubby. Is that you?
Yeah. No, I said it. That's grubby. Yeah. I started to imagine all the characters and what they were all up to. It was all a little bit racy. And
Yeah. It is grubby. I mean, the girls' school thing is grubby in 2022 eyes, especially.
Yeah. I mean, it is the main female characters in this song. He talks about it being, you know, oh, it's another series of vignettes. You know, I'm known for vignettes. That's my wheelhouse. The main characters are the mistresses, the school mistresses, rather than the girls.
Yeah.
Although it does seem to include them being drugged and beaten.
Yeah.
By the staff. So that's what?
Yeah, that all goes a bit Maxwell Silver Hammer for me at that point. At which point you've got to remember what I think of Maxwell Silver's Hammer lyrically, which is my least favourite Beatles lyrics, I think. Or at least, I think I
do worry about this sort of thing of like the lyrics book when you get things like so he talks about the first verse, which is sleepyhead kid sister lying on the floor. That's not good. 18 years and younger boy, well, she knows what she's waiting for. And in the lyrics book, he says, the Me Too movement is really what she was waiting for, but no one knew this at the time. So how do you extract that from that? I honestly don't know. And I don't think it does the Me Too movement any good service to make that sort of statement.
I don't think that this would be the kind of
suggests she's wanting to state about her experience of sexual abuse.
No.
You know, in solidarity with other, you know, victims.
No, I think he's being a little bit revisionist there. I don't know whether what he's doing there is having a head soup of kind of like, why would I have written a song like this at that time? Maybe he's talking to himself there. He's saying, I think what this character was needing was me not to have lived through the Me Too years and realised, maybe kind of like sexualising 18 and younger type of girls in the first line of a song isn't a great start.
It's not I saw her standing there. This is not rock and roll lyrics by young people for young people. This is a grown man working in a particular format and clearly having based it off the porn film. He even says in the book as well, like, some of this stuff may have been in the porn film. So it wasn't that you just saw an advert for it. He definitely watched this porn film.
I wonder if he's realised he's...
He's probably got it in his loft or something.
Yeah. No, we don't really need to go into it any more than that, I think. I've given you 38 for lyrics.
Yeah.
Which gives it 53.7 overall.
The only thing I'll say about the lyrics is on the reproduction of his handwritten notes, they've got the line, they put the papers on the window. They put the paper on the windows. And the way they pronounce it in the song is winders. But he's written windows, and he's written on his notes, winders. You know, so he's written, so he knew he was going to pronounce it like that.
Yeah. Grubby winders.
Mucky.
Mucky
McCartney. Mucky McCartney. Back again.
All right then. So
what was that in total? What did it get overall?
It was It was 53.7.
Oh, right.
So that takes us to the end of the week, and we can look at the non-top 10 charters, of which we have four of the five. So we have a new top 10, but we'll do the ones that didn't chart, and they go in this order. Paul McCartney, Girls School, 42. Ringo Starr, Down and Out, number 39. Paul McCartney, Little Woman Love, number 33. And George Harrison, Blow Away, 20. I think a respectable 20 for Blow Away there, given
should
some of the
competition.
Given some of the competition, Paul. Think it's a good pop song. Okay. I'll just carry on. So shall we do the top 10, the new top 10?
Yeah.
Okay. At number 10, Power to the People, John Lennon. At number 9, Paul McCartney and Jet. At number 8, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, John Lennon. At number 7, Kiss, 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 Yoko Ono. At number 6, Cold Turkey, John Lennon. At number 5, Give Peace a Chance, John Lennon. At number 4, Stand By Me, John Lennon. At number 3, Loving Song, Paul McCartney. At number 2, Band on the Run, Paul McCartney. And at number 1, Another Day, Paul McCartney. So we have the Lennon the Lennon Ono block kind of taking up the 4 to 8 spots. And then no Harrison or Starr at the moment.
No, there's definitely still contenders to come, though.
There is. I still think this is going to change a lot from what I know. But then I didn't expect Loving Song to be number 3 because I'd never heard it before.
Yeah.
I still think I stand by that, you know.
Well, it's too late now. You've done it.
I've
come
done
on.
It.
Doesn't move on.
So there we go. There we go. Episode 9 done. And thanks. And we will see you for episode 10 next week. Goodbye.
Beatles.